You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Coming up on episode 233 of Wheel Bearings, we've got hybrid Ford F-150s, Escape plug-in hybrids, V8 powered Jet and Grand Cherokees, poor fuel economy on new mail trucks, dealers charging too much money, and a redesigned Spirit of Ecstasy. All that and more coming up next. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. Episode 233 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abul Sandwich from Guidehouse Insights.
I am Nicole Wakelin from True Car.
And I am Roberto Baldwin. And I, what do I do? Oh, I do a column every week on LifeWire about EVs. Go read it.
All right. So what have you been driving this week, Mr. Baldwin?
Oh, man, I'm first. See, we don't know if we're first or not until Sam says something.
He springs it at us, and we both sit here like, oh gosh, am I ready? Am I ready?
Hope's not me.
Are you ready? If you're not ready, I can make it.
No.
That's why he's stalling, because he knows he's not ready.
Yeah, it's just like, hey, I drove the 2021 Ford Escape PHEV, the front-wheel drive version. It is the only version. Yeah, well, there you go.
There is no all-wheel drive plug-in hybrid.
Yeah, which is sort of sad. I kind of wish there was. Overall, I think it's a good vehicle. It's not it's tough because it's battling the RAV4. That's a tough especially the RAV4, the RAV4 Prime. Yeah. And that is a tough vehicle to battle in the PHEV market in that range. And if you're looking at the RAV4 Prime, then you're like, ooh, it's a... But having said that, I liked it more than I thought I would. I feel like older generation Escapes just sort of... I don't know. They just sort of irritated me for some reason. Sometimes you'll get in a car and they just kind of bug you. The last two generation Chevy Malibu did that. And I think that was no one liked the Malibu. It wasn't that it was a bad car, because it's hard to really build a bad car because manufacturing has gotten so good over the last 20 years. It's just that, it just wasn't, like, when you look at the Accord and the Camry and literally anything else in the market, it wasn't as good as those. Plus, I think for that car, what happened was you just kept thinking about what the Malibu used to be, like this cool car, like, oh, I got a Malibu. And then you get into this, like, junk box of a vehicle, which they have now. Like, it's gone. The Malibu is gone. I hope they bring it back as like a sweet like EV muscle car sometime in the future. The Ford Escape is now better than it was. It's not as good as the RAV4, unfortunately. It has its PHEV. Their MPG is, you know, gas only is 40, and then the MPGE, which is like some made up weird thing that the EPA has to like come up with to make people feel better, is 105, which is like, ooh, I got really good, just mixed, MPG around, I think 50, 51, which is pretty good.
That's not bad.
Yeah. But the weird thing was
better
when
than
I
some
did,
stuff.
Yeah, that was really, I was like, oh, okay. Now, their all-electric range is 38 miles. That's what it's supposed to be. Or 30, I'm looking at the Monroney right now, 38, 0 to 8, 38. And then, but then it says 37 on the, I'm like, I don't know. It doesn't matter because it didn't hit that. It hit 28 during my test. Now, I did it at night, so I don't, I try to do it at these PHEV tests, these all-electric tests at night, so I don't get stuck in traffic, which sort of throws off the whole thing. I try to do it after rush hour, so it's about the same amount of traffic every night around 7-ish p.m. I do the same route just around my neighborhood. There's, you know, I live near an interstate. I live near mountain roads. I live near, you know, urban. So I do the same route, and it just, I thought it would be, do better because it was doing so well. And so it's like 28, which is not great. And I was like, oh, okay, that's what it got. But it's still...
That's what it is.
Yeah. I'm like, all right. I'm sure probably other people have gotten better. I don't
know. Yeah, I got 40 when I did it, when I
drove
them last
fall. It was really weird. I was like, kind of like, what is happening? But yeah, 28. And maybe, I don't know, maybe do my math, check my math. I don't know. But it was 28. The blend of electric to motor is really nice. I didn't have any issues. It doesn't feel like it's sort of herky-jerky between old generation hybrids and PHEVs had this like weird, like it's gas, now it's electric, now it's gas, now it's electric, now it's gas. And or the engine just starts making all this crazy noise because it's spinning, but it's not really, you know, that's that noise doesn't translate to what's happening with the wheels. It doesn't match. And it doesn't have any of that. So overall, it did really well. My biggest complaint about this vehicle was the seats. I could not get comfortable in these seats. They were just a little bit too squishy.
Was it because you're taller? Like, it just didn't, or was it just in general, you're like, I don't like these.
I just didn't like them. And you know, I want to call them the John Cooper Mellencamp minis. I also hate those seats as well. For a different reason. The John Cooper Mellencamp minis.
This is a prime example of, you know, what we said before, why you should never buy a car without test driving it first. Ever.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Because every seat is different. You know, our seats in every vehicle are different. And, you know, everybody's body is different. And some seats just won't fit your body no matter what you do.
I felt like I've gotten in cars where people are like, oh, I love the seats in this car. And I will get into the car and I'm like, I can't. I got out after my the mileage run. I got out of the car. I was like, ugh. Where I just drive the car for hours and hours, just sort of get a feel for it without worrying about mileage. I felt like my back was wrecked.
Oh, geez, that's not good.
So I was just like, well, is it? It's, and again, this, like, you know, yeah, still 28. I'm still looking at my numbers. I'm still looking at my 28. And again, I think it really comes out. It's like your what is it, the beds that you can adjust? The adjustable beds?
The Craftmatic adjustable
bed. Sleep number bed. It's like a sleep number bed situation, you know. Lots of people have probably gotten in this vehicle, have sat down and been like, oh, these are the best seats I've ever sat in. I love these seats. They're nice and squishy. They're billowy. They're great. I get in and I'm like, this will be fine. And then after a few hours behind the road, I'm like, this is not fine. And at the same time, I can get into essentially a race car with race seats. And those are I love those. I feel like those are just built for my body. That's it. That's the only, like, they looked at me and they're like, yeah, let's make it for this guy. It'll be fine. Those are great. I could sit in those seats for hours. And yet, a nice squishy seat in the Ford Escape, no, not so much. So, you know, like Sam was saying, get into the car, drive it, sit in it, kind of like know what you like. Like, get into your car you own right now, and when you're driving hours and hours, you're still comfortable when you get out of that car. Remember how your car feels, some of the squishiness and some of it's gone because you've been sitting in it for, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of miles.
Right.
But like, kind of get a sense of like what you like when you're behind the wheel. Especially, and a good way to do that is also when you rent cars, see how those cars feel. And then go out and find a car and sit in it. Because if you buy a car that you absolutely adore, and then it turns out the seats just do not agree with you. Oh, that's going to be a bad time. Overall, though, the Ford Escape, the weird mileage issue aside, and the fact that my body doesn't like squishy seats. I think it's a solid vehicle. I think it's a win for Ford. I think they probably sold a billion of these, as Ford tends to do. I'm sad it's front wheel drive. The version I drove, I got the titanium. Yeah, the titanium version. So of course, all the things. So the price was $43,000, which. All right.
It's not inexpensive.
It's not cheap.
No, but then again, not much is these days anymore.
That's true. Like nothing's inexpensive anymore. So, it's not cheap. If you're a Ford fan, if you've been driving Fords forever, you'll probably be more than happy just to hop behind the wheel. And, Sam got 40-ish miles. I got 27. I'm not sure what the discrepancy is in that still.
Were you driving uphill all the way?
No, it was the same.
Uphill both ways?
See, there are hills around where I live, but other cars have gotten way better mileage. I don't, yeah.
On the downhill side, you're going to make up mileage that what you lose on the going uphill. So,
yeah,
it all evens out in the end.
Yeah, so I think maybe my driving is more mixed when it comes uphills, and then the downhill, it doesn't have that much. You can see it's sort of like charging as you're slowing down. But it's not, a lot. So maybe maybe in some of the other vehicles I've done, they have a little bit more regen, and so that helps them. I do live in a sort of a hilly area, Northern California. I live on a hill. That's a there's a hill over there, and a hill over there, and a hill over there. That's why we have great roads, because we have to drive around all these crazy hills. So there's that. Overall, Ford Escape, front wheel drive. If you don't want a RAV4, that's the
For what it's worth, I think part of the reason why Ford opted not to do an all-wheel drive version, at least for now, on the Escape plug-in hybrid, is because they also have the Lincoln Corsair, which the plug-in hybrid version of that, at the front, you've got the exact same engine and hybrid drive system, and then they added a rear electric motor, an electric motor on the rear axle to drive the rear wheels, so you get all-wheel drive with that one. Similar setup to what Toyota's got on the RAV4 Prime. Mm-hmm. I think at least for a year or two, they want to have that be something that is only for Lincoln, and then at some point they might add an all-wheel drive version, all-wheel drive option to the Escape.
Could be.
I think it looks better, but I think that the baller thing. I want the Ford Bronco Sport we have.
Yeah,
that'd be cool.
That's sort of like, okay, this is a good car, but it could be so much better, because the Bronco Sport is so much better. And it's not that much more expensive from the it's a couple thousand dollars more. I don't know now because of dealer markups, but in fantasy world where we don't have insane dealer markups for anything with the word Bronco attached to it, it's only a few thousand dollars more.
People pay normal prices for things.
Yeah. If you love Ford, if you need a solid, again, it's a solid car. It's not a bad car. There's nothing inherently wrong with it. It gets good gas mileage if Sam's driving it, not so great if I'm driving it. You got the Ford Escape.
Not everything gets good gas mileage in my hands, and we'll talk about that later.
Okay. But again, the overall MPG was really good. It was like 50 something. So I'm just like, what's happening?
It was
really weird. I probably should have done like three tests and seen what was and picked, throw out the top and the bottom and tipped the middle. But, I got a week with the car, and you're just like, okay, these are the days I'm doing this. This is the day I'm doing
this.
Right,
when you can do it, yeah.
I think when I drove the Corsair plug-in hybrid in December, that one got about 28 miles on a charge. But, it's also significantly heavier than the Escape is. It's got a lot more equipment in there. You've got the rear electric motor. So it's doing a lot more work. So I expect that one to be, I think it was like, 500 or 600 pounds heavier than the Escape plug-in hybrid. So I expect that to get less range. So I'm really kind of surprised that you got that little with that one. But
Sometimes I guess it's just maybe it's a fluke. I'll have to figure out what happened. Again, the blending was so good. Mm-hmm. The vehicle blending, the hybrid system blending has gotten so it's like up there with BMW's blending.
Yeah, well,
right now.
Ford's been doing hybrids for a long time now. You know, so. They launched the first Escape hybrid back in 2004 or 2005. You know, so they've been doing them 16, 17 years now, almost as long as Toyota. And so, you know, I would expect them to be able to you know make it perform really well.
Yeah, but I don't think people like really think about Ford when they think hybrids. Because everyone thinks
Toyota. Which is strange.
Everyone thinks Toyota.
Yeah. Yeah.
Toyota's like Prius.
Yeah. And, you know, Ford is has sold the second greatest number of hybrids, only behind Toyota.
Yeah, but no one remembers who got the silver medal.
That's true.
We all remember Mary Lou Retton. We don't remember who got silver at those
Olympics.
We really
don't.
Yeah. Who got silver in the 1984 Olympics?
Some other girl who was
not
in
Mary, not Mary
not
Lou.
Not Mary Lou. Lou Mary Lou won.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, Nicole, what have you been in?
I am in a 2022 Jeep Grand Cherokee Overland 4x4, and I have to do a shout out to Jeep because the last couple cars I've gotten have not had the Monronis that they are like other cars or they're other trims or there's just not one at all, and I'm like, we'll wing it. Today I have this perfect little Monroni. It's like a little cardboard cutout, and it has like it's like heavy cardstock, and Ooh. It has every last stinking detail. And these are the ones that are in the cars. Like if you go on a drive program with Jeep, they put these little cardboardy things. I was so happy. I'm like, boy, it doesn't take much on a Sunday morning. I'm like, oh, a Monroni that's actually right. I was so happy. So thank you, Jeep, for putting these in your cars when you send them out into the fleets because it made my life easy. So that's what I was driving. It has a 5.7 liter V8 Hemi, 357 horsepower, 390 pound-feet of torque, 8-speed automatic. It feels like a big, beefy vehicle when you're driving it. But what I like about that, this isn't like a downmarket vehicle. It's pretty fancy, especially in the Overland. You don't want it to feel like you're driving something like rough and ready. And even though you feel the power of this vehicle, it never feels harsh. It never feels too much. The engine isn't overly loud. Like, you know, it's doing its job, but it's still like well-mannered. It's like, oh, you're driving along in your Jeep. You're just, you know, cruising on the highway. Now you want it to feel like a nice highway cruiser. And it does. It does a fantastic job of that. That's neat because having taken this off-road, you can really take this off-road and it's truly capable, which is a sort of like strange dichotomy. It's like I can have my fancy little on-road vehicle and then I can go thrash it on the weekends and get it dirty and take it over rocks, which is kind of what makes Jeeps really cool. This one had a base price of $55,305. So base price, pricey, but not insane. Once you add in all the options that are on the one that I am driving, $70,360. That is $15,000 worth of options on this. And I was looking like, so what did we pay extra? We paid $400 for silver Zenith exterior paint. I don't know that I'd pay $400 for silver, but somebody will.
All right.
Like silver paint.
Okay. Silver's like cheap, the zero paint. That's the $0 paint. But okay, go for it.
This isn't just silver, Robbie.
Zenith.
This is silver Zenith exterior paint.
Is it made from ground up Zenith televisions?
I don't know, but it's like spelled Zynith. Isn't Zenith Zynet? Or am I thinking of the TV? I don't know. Anyway, it also gets a luxury tech group number 4. This is where the money starts coming from. It's $2,000. An advanced protection group, $2,000. A black roof, $700. A front passenger interactive display, which is a grand, and I'll talk about that. Rear seat entertainment is another $2,000. And the Uconnect 5 navigation with 10.1-inch display is $1,700. Plus the $1,795 destination fee, rounding things a little bit, that's how you get to $70,000 in your Jeep Grand Cherokee. So the luxury group really does... It does feel like a luxury car. You get Nappa leather seats. You get a wireless charging pad. There's a 12-way adjustable driver seat and front passenger seat. You got 4-zone automatic climate control. So it does all the cute little fun luxury things that you want in a car to make it feel like it's a fancy pants vehicle, and it does that. Then you get some other stuff in this advanced production group, which is like, it has this one feature that is so cool. Okay, night vision with pedestrian and animal detection. Have either of you driven this and played with that?
Yes.
Not on the Jeep, but I have on the Cadillac Escalade.
Okay.
It has a similar system where when at night when you turn that on the display, it'll put a little bounding box when it detects animals or people around you.
So it's super cool. And I was playing with it. I thought, what better night to turn this on? We got a storm in typical New England fashion. It's like, you guys, it's just going to be like a little dusting. Woof, tons of snow and ice and sleet. And the roads are a mess. And you can't. And I'm like, oh, I'm glad I picked tonight to go out to dinner. So we're driving back. I'm like, I'm going to try this as I'm going on these like twisty, turny New Hampshire scenic back roads that are the only way to get to this stupid restaurant that we picked. So I turned this on. It was really cool how well it sort of cleared up the fuzz of the snow and the sort of harsh, how hard it was to see. Suddenly you're like, I can literally see where the edge of the snowbank is. Like you can see the curve of the snowbank. And the neat thing was, and this wasn't like a danger thing, but there was someone in their driveway on the far side of their car clearing off their car. They weren't coming out into the road. They weren't anywhere near like being in danger. But all of a sudden I see this flash of yellow and I'm like, what did I just see on the screen? It flashes again. It was picking up the person on the other side of their car and warning me that there was a person there so that I could see it. And I totally, honest to God, had no idea she was there except for this because she's a fancy little yellow box. Like first it sort of picks up the fact that there's a person and you can kind of see the person moving and then it gives the box. I couldn't even see the person, but it knew there was something there. So if there was like an animal or something about to run into the road, that totally would have given you that warning. Like there is a deer hiding behind that tree that is about to run out into you. I thought it was really cool. And then I had my husband get out and like play with it. And it's kind of neat when he first walks in front of the car, he's just glowy and you see like him and it's like as if you see like the trees and the other objects that are around you. He has to get enough that the system can go, that's not just something, that's a human. And it's before his whole body really is in front of it. Relatively quickly it realizes, nope, that's a moving living thing, and it makes this little yellow box so that you can't possibly miss it. Or if you're like focusing on the road and you're just kind of using that sort of as a backup helper thing, that yellow box gets your attention. It's really neat. And that's part of that advanced pro-tech group.
Pro-tech.
Because you can trademark technology. Pro-tech, not protect.
Is right. It T-E-H-T-E-C-H, like pro, like professional technology? Like,
yes, pro-tech group, and it's pro-tech group number 3. Not protect, like protect
Mambo
serve,
number,
like, the,
like yeah. Mambo number 5.
Like Mambo number 5, only with fancy night vision.
Ooh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really neat because I have getting to play with that in a situation where you thought this is exactly where you wouldn't be able to see that there was a dog or a deer or some animal coming out in front of you. And it was it totally worked. I was like, go engineering people. That was really nifty. So I like that. The thing that we didn't like, my daughter didn't like it because really this is her playing with it. She's 18. She was sitting in the front seat and she was playing with a little interactive display that because there's a display screen on the passenger side and you really can't see it from the driver's side. If you try and see it from the driver's side, it's like as if you had looking at someone's laptop that has a screen protect, like a privacy screen in front of it. You cannot see it from the angle where you're sitting. And I, when the car was parked, I tried to see how far over I had to lean and literally my head is like on her shoulder before I can even remotely tell that there's something on that screen. So there's no way the driver is going to be able to like zone out and watch with on that screen.
That's good.
I don't know if this was a setting, but every time we turned the car off and on, we had to go back in and say, yes, activate this. Yes, let her use this every single time. And I don't know if there was a setting, but I could not find it. And we like poked around everywhere and it's like buried, you know. So that was my only quibble with that. And it didn't do as much. Like features wise, she was kind of like, well, I can't do this. I can't do that. I can't do the other thing. So I think for her, she wanted it to do sort of almost everything you could do on the infotainment, but not be the actual infotainment and like let you. And it doesn't do that. It's very limited in the features. So nifty, but she was unimpressed. And I'm giving her review because she's the one who had to use it. So
does it have Tetris?
I don't know if it had Tetris. She's 18. She'd be like, Tetris, what's that?
No, kids know Tetris. I don't know. Maybe they don't.
Did it have the Amazon Fire TV stuff turned on?
I didn't play with that. No, so I'm not sure if that was turned on or not. But she was, I forget what she was. There were a couple different features. She's like, oh, I can't do this. oh, I can't do that. And I'm like, what? She's like, no, I just, there's things that I could, and she's like playing on the infotainment screen and going back and forth. And I guess she just felt like there were more features that she wanted to see be able to be used by the person there. Because, like, you know, you figure if you're the passenger, like, the idea is you could watch the Amazon and watch your movie or watch your video, which is cool, and the driver can't watch it. But wouldn't it be nice for you to have a screen that was right in front of you instead of having to lean over in a big car like the Grand Cherokee? And, like, if you want to do something to reach over to the infotainment screen as the passenger, you could just tap the screen in front of you.
I like the passenger screens. I like the idea that's polarized where you can't see. So
yes,
you know,
absolutely.
Because people are going to watch. They're going to want to watch whatever.
Oh, 100%. And if they're even if you're not trying to, it's like, you know, it's like you're trying to work and there's a TV on and you're like, you're sitting in a lounge or something.
You're going to get distracted.
And you suddenly you're like, I don't even care what's on there. And what am I watching? Is this an info, like a commercial new gutters? I don't need new gutters. Why am I being distracted by this? But you are.
Or sitting in a restaurant, you know, to grab some dinner, and you know, being distracted by the TVs all over the place.
Yeah, like sometimes I'll be eating in a taqueria, and there's always soccer on. Yeah.
Is that the thing? Soccer.
Yeah, it's always soccer, and so I don't care about any sport. I don't watch any sports. I just don't care. Yeah. I tried. I tried as a kid. I'm sorry. I wanted to fit in, and it just didn't work. So
yeah.
But if it's on, and I'm sitting there eating a taco, and I'm talking to someone, my eyes, it's like entertainment drift. You're just like,
right, exactly. And I think that's exactly what would happen. If you were driving a car and someone's watching a video that you could actually see the movie, you'd be like, what's happened over there? That looks pretty exciting. Ah, a tree. Like, no, it's never going to work out well. So, has to be something you can't see as a driver.
Yeah. So does it play the audio from the video through the vehicle audio system, or do you have to use headphones to hear the audio from that?
I think it has to – I want to say it's headphones because you can pair your – she could pair her headphones to it or something.
Yeah, because I know like most of the rear seat entertainment systems come with, you know, wireless headphones that you know that are paired to that, so you use the kids sitting in the back and you know use the headphones.
Can do that while the grown-ups up front.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm just wondering.
Yeah, so you could. So I mean, that somebody sitting in the passenger seat could entirely watch a movie while you did the task of driving, and it's not an arduous task because this is a nice car to drive. You know, it's it's big, but even without, I think, all those luxury packages that are in there, the Pro Tech or the Luxury Tech, it feels neat because it runs that, you know, if you want to go off-road in this, if you really want to, you know, get it filthy dirty, go off-road where, you know, lesser cars fear to tread, you can do that. But then it's just as capable of being this super comfy family highway cruiser. It has a really nice, comfy interior. I like the Jeep. I thought it was nice.
And this is a two-row, right? Not the
Yes,
Grand
this
Cherokee
isn't
L.
The, this isn't the L. This is just the two-row. So the L is a whole different animal. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a bigger animal. Had more
bigger animal
Wheaties.
Has a bigger butt.
And I forget what kind of fuel economy did you say you got out of this thing?
The state of fuel economy is 14 city 22 highway. Most of my driving in this was on really horrific winter roads, stop and go, snowy weather. So I feel like my fuel economy, I was mostly on side roads. I was getting like 15 or so, 14, like in there, depending. But I honestly feel like it could have done better if I wasn't giving it the worst possible roads to slog through. Because that's not, you know, your wheels slip and you're braking constantly. And it is not good for fuel economy to drive on those roads. So it's like, it was like 14, 15 popping back and forth. So.
Excellent. Yeah. And, you know, I was driving this week the 2022 Ford F-150, or actually, no, sorry. It's a 2021 F-150 4x4 Super Crew Platinum Power Boost.
How do you put that in a headline? A good thing you're talking about it, not writing about it.
Yeah. So this is the F-150 hybrid that you know has been promised for many, many years. Finally launched with this current generation of F-150 that came out in late 2020. I had specifically requested this one. Well, what I requested was an F-150 that had Blue Cruise, so I could do some testing with Blue Cruise. This one has all the Blue Cruise hardware on it. The Monroney says Blue Cruise, so you know they specified it. But this one has not yet gotten the software update to actually turn on Blue Cruise. I did not get to try Blue Cruise, even though you know when I turned on, you know, when I was on the highway, I turned on the cruise control. You know, it said active drive assist, you know, enabled, but it never actually enabled the hands-free mode. It what it did was it showed me the icon, which shows up in the middle of the tack on the left-hand side of the gauge with the steering wheel, and it showed hands on the steering wheel all the time. Mm-hmm. But never showed me the hands-off version of that so I could go hands-free. What was interesting, though, what I did notice is that even though this doesn't have, you know, I wasn't using the hands-free mode, you know, part of what Ford has done, you know, similar to what GM is doing and has been doing since they launched Super Cruise, and what other manufacturers are doing as they launch their hands-free systems, is they have infrared cameras on the dash. There's one that is right at the base of the A-pillar by the mirror, and then there's another one that's just above the center touchscreen display that are looking at you as you drive to make sure that you're watching the road when you're using these systems. And even when you're just using standard adaptive cruise control with lane centering, even when you're not hands-off, it does, in fact, it is still watching you. And if you look away from the road for more than a few seconds, it will give you an alert saying, hey, watch the road, please. Keep your eyes on the road. So that's good. The one of the things that, you know, from my previous brief experiences with Blue Cruise, that I'm not thrilled with the way Ford has done it. You know, one of the things that Ford didn't do that GM and others are doing is include capacitive sensors in the steering wheel to detect when your hands are actually on the wheel. And they are relying on the same cheaper approach that Tesla uses, which is to look for motion in the steering wheel. You know, it's using the torque sensor in the steering wheel and looking for that motion, that little bit of motion that you typically have when you're driving. And the problem with that is, you know, if you actually do try to hold your hands really steady on that and don't have any motion, even if your hands are on the wheel and you're holding the steering wheel, it will still think, oh, there's no motion on the steering wheel.
Like, you must not have your hands there.
Yeah.
Yep.
So yeah, I'll have my hands.
So I kept getting alerts to put my hands on the wheel, even when they were on the wheel, which I thought was rather annoying. So I don't like that. And I wish Ford would put the capacitive sensors in there.
It's like every 5 minutes you have to do a little wheel tremor. Because yeah. I'll be driving, and I keep my
hands a little.
I want to keep my hands on the wheel because I don't want to die. And I'll be driving, and I'm looking at, you know, I'm looking at what's going on, and so I don't feel like I have to keep an eye on the cluster, because mm-hmm. you know, I'm looking at the world, and I look down, and it's like, hey, you need to put your hands on the wheel. I'm like, what do you think I've been doing? So I did a little
just
little tremor. Give a little jiggle every once in a while to say, hey, I'm still here.
Na 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 na.
Yeah. So that's rather annoying. But it turns out, you know, the truck was delivered on Wednesday morning here, just a few hours before we started getting, you know, it was actually raining at the time, and it was just before we started getting, you know, fairly significant snowfall. Not quite as much as what you got in your neck of the woods, Nicole, but we had about 8 or 9 inches around where I am here. And so it was nice to have a big four-wheel drive truck. The downside of that is, as you mentioned, you know, these kinds of conditions, you know, in the aftermath of a snowstorm, you get all this snow and slush and ice on the roads. It does cause a lot more drag. And another downside of a big truck like this is, you know, one thing that you should always do after it snows is brush all the snow and ice off your car so that it's not flying off and running
other cars
behind you. That's kind of hard to do on a big truck like that. You can't. I mean, unless you're as tall as Roberto.
No,
you
know, the F-150 is a big. The F-150 is a big truck.
Unless you're a giant.
I couldn't reach I could probably reach about a foot into the top of the F-150. Every time. Yeah, it's a big vehicle. I couldn't reach across it, and I would need a step stool or the hop in the bed in order to clean it off. So
yeah,
you got to be really tall in order to do that.
So you know, there was a fair bit of, you know, accumulated ice and stuff on the front of the truck, and you know, some snow and ice on the roof, which you know, got over the course of the snowstorm, you know, there was a fair bit of ice accumulated there, which you know, causes a lot more aerodynamic drag. And so, you know, during my test loop the other day, you know, which is basically the same drive loop I do for pretty much everything, I went out and drove for a couple hours, and the The hybrid F-150, four-wheel drive hybrid F-150, is rated at 24 miles per gallon, city, highway, and combined. I've only averaged about 15 and a half, which is not great.
Cold.
It was cold. As I said, you got all the snow and ice. Plus, it turns out, I found out that I also had about 400 pounds of snow and ice in the bed of the truck. Because one of the cool new features that Ford has on the F-150.
Oh, my gosh. That's so cool.
Is the bed scales. They've got load sensors under the bed. And also, this one had the smart hitch option. So, if you're trailering, when you hook up your trailer and put it on there, you can go on the screen and see exactly how much weight is on the, how much tongue weight you've got on that trailer to make sure you're not overloading your truck. Or when you're loading stuff into the bed, you can see exactly how much stuff you've got loaded in there. So I went out there this morning and, hit the scales, and I had roughly about 400 pounds of snow and ice in the bed of the truck.
That's how much that all weighed. I mean, that's now I know why when you feel like you shovel your driveway, you think you're going to die when one of those storms. Was it really almost 500 pounds?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when the storm started here on very early, Wednesday morning, the temperature was about 37. So it was actually raining at first and gradually turned from rain to ice to snow. And so, there was a lot of wet, heavy snow there early on. And
you have a nice layer of ice too to keep the snow from melting out.
Yeah, exactly. So, so that also, all these things combined, caused it to get underwhelming fuel economy. Because I remember when I did the media drive, the launch drive, when they first started building the 21s back in late 2020, I drove a hybrid, for a couple of hours, and I think I averaged about 22, 23 at that time. So I certainly expected to get less, not quite this much less, but it's not.
But you're hauling a bunch of, two people's worth of snow.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Yeah, we actually had that.
I just like the idea you could just weigh things. I'm just throwing things
in the way. How much does this weigh? I don't know. Put it in the truck. Let's find out. We had the similar situation with the snow and ice, and it took forever to clear all the snow off the top of the Grand Cherokee because it's hard to reach, and it was so icy you can't just reach up there and grab it. I'm like, I need a step stool to smash, 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 smash to break it all up. It was a big story up here because as we're driving down the highway, even though people had a very tiny amount of snow stuck to their cars, it was like a sheet of ice. So as it came loose, it came with these giant sheets that were smacking into other cars. They had these record number of vehicles that were having smashed windshields and damage.
Wow.
Because of smacking in. It was really bad. So I was driving around. I was looking at the cars in front of me no, that roof looks clean. Oh, no, that roof doesn't look clean. We're going to ease back a little bit.
I've had it.
Well, on Thursday afternoon, towards the end of the storm period, I actually had to go into Ann Arbor, into downtown Ann Arbor, to meet up with a couple of people from a company called Under that is making a new kind of imaging radar that's going to be standard on the Fisker Ocean. They wanted to give me a demo, which was a pretty cool demo. But on the way home, I was stopped at a red light, and I'm sharing this photo with you guys right now so you can see.
Oh, no. He was not driving like that.
Did not even bother brushing off the back window. And this was not the only car I saw like this. I'll include this in the show notes.
Oh, my gosh. Do you guys have that law? We have a law in New Hampshire that you have to clear it. You do.
Yeah. We have a law. It doesn't really get enforced very much, apparently.
Oh, but they enforce it like crazy in New Hampshire. You drive over, they weren't, yesterday it was because everyone, with such small skim coat of snow left on the car, I didn't see them pull anyone over, but they would pull that car over in a heartbeat in New Hampshire.
Yeah. I think this person, basically just brushed off enough so that when they opened the door, they wouldn't get all the snow
inside.
And just, maybe a little patch of the windshield, probably.
There's a porthole that they've created.
There's probably a circle. Yeah, just a circle big enough, so you can see your eyes. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see it. It's good enough.
So please, if you're driving after a snowstorm, brush your car off. Make sure you clean off the snow, clean off the ice so you can see out and also so that it's not flying into the cars behind you.
Breaking cars and causing accidents and such. That's not good.
That's bad behavior. Bad road etiquette.
Bad
form.
Etiquette.
All right. So they did send me a Monroney for this F-150, which had all the details of all the options that are on here, including the lovely 12-inch Sync 4 touchscreen display, which has support for both wireless Android Auto and Apple CarPlay. It had this truck had the optional double pane power moonroof, which would have been lovely, if it wasn't all
covered with ice on
top. lots of other options, the max trailer tow package. But unfortunately, because this was probably a pre-production vehicle, it looks like from the VIN that it was a pre-production model, so it was before they actually started shipping them to dealers. It does not include a price on it, but I went on the Ford.com website and priced out is pretty much the same package of options. And this one came to $76,090 for this truck. And this, granted, this is not the most expensive F-150 you can get, because this is just the Platinum. You can also get the Limited, which has even more stuff in it. This one did have the fold-out work table, which was so lovely for your cookies.
Cookie table.
For your cookies.
I didn't go out
and get any cookies.
It's the burrito table, but sure.
Yeah.
Burrito table?
It depends on where you are in the United States.
I get these messages that are like, work table. I'm like, no, it's a snack table. Choose the snack of your choice. Yeah. Burritos, cookies, some fries, chicken nuggets. That's what it is. And it's amazing.
Anybody that's going to use that as a work surface is not going to be buying a Platinum. They're going to get an XLT.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, it might be the supervisor.
The boss is going to be eating his lunch on there. He's going to be eating his custom burrito.
It's a snack.
there was something else here that I wanted to mention as well, which is escaping me now. This one. It also had the lay flat seats, which if you've driven, this new generation of F-150s, they have these optional lay flat seats. So if you need to take a nap, you can recline the front seats almost all the way back. So it's basically like flying in a business class seat, and it's great for taking a nap over your lunch break.
After eating that burrito.
That's right.
On your work table.
Nothing goes with a burrito better than a nap.
Better than a nap, pretty much.
All right. So that's the 2021 Ford F-150. Power Boost Platinum Super Crew 4x4.
You're getting your money's worth, at least in the name.
That's right.
The name.
At least cost a couple extra dollars
in that alone. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, well, you're getting lots of monies.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All right. So let's stick with the theme of fuel economy for a minute. Get into some news here.
This is a crazy story. I feel like this is one of those, I look at this and think, was that real? Was that an Onion story? Oh, no. This is a real story.
This is real. The U.S. Postal Service has been trying to get new mail trucks for, I don't know, about 20 years now. The current vehicles that your letter carrier uses to deliver your mail and your packages was originally designed in the 1980s, and it was named the Long Life Vehicle, LLV. And it was meant for a 20-year life cycle. And that was 40 years ago. So the average age of these trucks that are still in the fleet today is something around 33 or 34 years old now, I think.
Wow.
These things were originally based on the first generation Chevy S10 chassis. So they had basically the suspension and brakes and everything from an S10 and the GM 2.5 liter four cylinder. And these things average about 8.2 miles per gallon in typical use, delivering your mail. they also have, in recent years, developed a tendency to catch fire because of things like the power steering pumps developing leaks and leaking hydraulic fluid around.
Small issues.
So they've had a few of them that have burned to the ground. Since 2015, the Postal Service has been trying. They've had a request for proposals, and they went through a quote process and everything. And a whole bunch of companies originally entered, and ultimately came down to two companies, and they finally made a decision in 2021, and they went with a bid from Oshkosh Defense, which builds a lot of trucks for the military, and Oshkosh had partnered with Ford, and so this mail truck was designed for using a lot of hardware from the Ford Transit van, which, unlike the E-Transit that Robbie drove last week, is not especially fuel efficient. The last time I had a regular Transit that I used to help my daughter move, I got about 12 miles per gallon, and that was just in city driving. It's not especially fuel efficient. And the Oshkosh bid included options for both an internal combustion version of this new mail truck and an electric version. So the Postal Service could choose whatever mix of those that they wanted. And one other thing to keep in mind is that part of the specs that the Postal Service gave, for these trucks, they wanted them to be larger, to have more payload capability, because they're delivering a lot more packages and parcels now than they had when the old ones were designed. And they also wanted to add things like air conditioning and other safety features that to make life a little easier for the drivers. This thing is a bigger, heavier vehicle. So you would expect that, probably not going to be great on fuel economy with a gas engine. Turns out that according to the EPA, this thing only gets about 8.6 miles per gallon. So
womp, womp.
Less than half a mile per gallon better than the 40-year-old truck.
It's 2022, people. It's 2022. Fuel efficiency has increased on vehicles. You can get more efficient engines, but nah.
Why? How? I don't even know how this happens. Like, how? Well, I do. It's the government. They're here to help. Maybe that's not what happens, but it's this is just like, how does somebody look at all this, make this bid, and go, yeah, that's the truck we're going with, the one with a crappy fuel economy. Let's go. All in. What is it?
Well, the 482
million.
The two finalists for this deal were Oshkosh and Workhorse Group.
Okay, so I don't even know why Workhorse was a finalist, because they've built like one truck.
Well, because they were the only one that was offering only an electric truck, and they wanted to have an EV.
I could have
been a final bid on that, because that's how much of a company Workhorse is, to be completely honest.
Yeah.
It's like I could have said, yeah, I'll make you guys an EV.
And we should have done that. We should have just come up. We should have been the wheel bearings. We could have just done our EV, and we could have made $482 million.
I know.
Well, this is ultimately like an $11 billion program, because they're replacing a couple of 180,000 trucks, and then, eventually also adding charging equipment into the postal depots and, post offices and stuff like that. It turns out for some reason, Louis DeJoy is even now still the Postmaster General. Why he hasn't been fired yet remains a mystery, but he is still the Postmaster General. Apparently he's the one that made the decision that, we're going to go with Oshkosh, and we're probably only going to go with about a 10% mix of EVs out of these.
I don't get it.
This is ridiculous.
It's just a fundamental misunderstanding of what EVs can and can't do. Or you just like, I'm just going to do EV, the 10%. I'm going to say 10%, and the reality is it's going to be 2%, because I have friends in the oil and the fossil fuel industry. And I hate saying things like that, but like it's when it comes to politicians, because everyone likes to say that journalists are on the take. Like, none of us are on the take. I've seen our houses.
Yeah.
I've seen how we all live. I worked in journalism in a bunch of different fields. I've been to a bunch of different newsrooms. Unless you're like the, on the morning show or Dan Rather, you know, unless you're, you know,
unless you're Woodward Bernstein.
Yeah,
you know,
you're not.
You get huge book deals. Yeah,
there's we're all posting pictures of like the one time we went out to a nice steak dinner at like a mid-level place, and we're like, look at I'm living large. We're not.
I have a steak. Tomorrow, like, it's back to ramen.
I know, so tomorrow, I had a steak today. The rest of the week, it's ramen.
Yep.
So we're not, yeah. So it's, but it, it's just, you save so much money. The e-transit's right there. And I guess someone was throwing around a $65,000 price tag for each one of these. I was like, but the e-transit starts at $45,000. How is this? Government contracts. It's the government contract bidding system.
Unless I missed in the story, there's been no response. Has there been a response from the Postal Service saying why?
Not yet.
The letter from the EPA, I just love how it's written. A stern letter from the EPA is what the subhead is. And it's like literally all these like bullet points. You did this wrong. I feel like there's like what? Has to be at least a dozen bullet points of things that they think that the Postal Service did wrong. And it feels to me that the like essence of like when you're a kid and you get that like thing you did really well on, you think at school, and you get it back and you see it and there's just red pen everywhere. I feel like the EPA is like, break out the red pen. No. And like went and circled everything wrong. And it's like the entire thing is a mess of red pen. They did nothing right.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, some of the points here, the Postal Service's own analysis showed that nearly 95% of mail carrier routes could be electrified, but only allocated 10% of electrified vehicles. I mean, if you think about it, you know, unless you live, you know, in a very rural area.
Alaska.
Yeah. You know, most mail routes are well under 100 miles a day.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially if you live in an urban or suburban area, which is where the vast majority of the population is, and that's where most of the mail trucks operate. You know, you're talking, you know, slow speed operations. You know, and mail trucks don't go racing around my neighborhood.
It's always, and two houses stop, two houses stop.
You know, stop. You're stopping every 50, 75 feet and then going again, you know, to put the mail in. This is you could not find a better application for an electric vehicle.
I feel like if you had a 100 mile EPA range mail truck, it would probably get 200 miles just from all the stopping.
Because the EPA, you're gonna get a lot of regen out of these things.
Yeah, just like and if you just set it up where it just turns off, you don't have to turn it off every time because the mail carrier is like turning it off. You just get in, get out. It's such a great opportunity to say, you know, this is the perfect application, and it is the most perfect application for an EPA.
This is exactly why you'd want this. Yes.
This is why Amazon has ordered 100,000 electric vans from Rivian, you know,
They even cite out further down here, like, the letter also cites concerns over competitors like Walmart, FedEx, UPS committing to fully electric fleets by 2040 and 2050. With significant near-term fully EV fleet purchases already made. Yeah. Other guys are like, we're in. It's like, hello, Postal Service, knack, knack, knack. We don't want efficient vehicles. Thanks, bye.
I just feel like Oshkosh and the Postal Service are just going to like ignore this until it falls out of the news cycle, and then we're just going to get, you know.
Yeah, well, because nothing's going to change. The way these things move and how slowly they move when stuff is approved is done. Like, this is what we're getting for the next, how old do you say the average one is right now? 43 years?
40 years.
So in another 43 years, they might actually commit to whatever we're using today in 43 years.
In 43 years, we'll have these like really nice, like super solid state batteries that get like 700 miles and they take 2 seconds to charge. And they'll be like, yeah, we're going to use lithium ion. It's going to take 14 hours of charge, and it's only a 200 kilowatt hour battery. Like, wait,
and it costs twice as much.
And these postal trucks sit overnight every day anyway at the post office. It's not like these things run 24 hours a day. So you don't even have to fast charge them. You can trickle charge them.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they'll last. And you're going to save money on brakes. You're going to save money on maintenance because, you know, you're not going to have.
Well, they would have if they bought the wheel bearings EV, but instead they bought this thing, so they're not saving anything.
We got to get our bid system.
We got to get our bid. Let's come up with a number, boys.
Yep, the wheel bearings EV, the WBEV, the wheel bearings, WBEV,
LeBev?
We'll think of a better name.
We'll come up with something better.
Pen pending. There you go. I don't want anyone stealing our ideas.
You're LeBev.
Okay. Next up. We've talked on several occasions previously about dealers and the ridiculous markups that they are doing, especially on some of the more popular vehicles right now. You know, we've seen dealers, you know, demanding customers, you know, pay $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 more for a Ford Mustang Mach-E or an F-150 Lightning. And this week, Ford had their fourth quarter earnings call. And I guess during the analyst call, Jim Farley, the CEO of Ford, actually called out dealers. You know, he was asked about this, I think. And he responded, you know, about this problem. He said that roughly about, from their analysis, about 10% of their dealer network has been charging above MSRP. And he's not happy about it. Barclays analyst Brian Johnston estimated the value of the markups is about at about $3.6 billion just in the fourth quarter. So, you know, that's a lot of money, a lot of extra money.
And, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. So, you know, Farley responded, you know, said, we have good knowledge of who they are. I mean, you know, Ford knows what the transaction prices are. That all gets reported back to Ford. So they know how much dealers are charging. They know which dealers are charging these markups. It says, we have very good knowledge of who they mm-hmm. are, and their future allocation of product will be directly impacted. So, you know, Farley's a marketer. I mean, he's a car guy, but, you know, he came up, his specialty was in marketing. He was head of marketing for Scion, you know, when he worked at Toyota. He came to Ford as, you know, their head of marketing. You know, he knows how to sell vehicles, you know, how to do customer experience. And he knows that this is bad news. You know, this is something that's really going to piss off customers. Mm-hmm. And so he apparently is taking a stand on this and says, if a dealership has a middle name, Farley's using it right now, like a father calling out a kid who is about to get into trouble. which this is from the article from Kristen Shaw in The Drive.
Yeah, that was great wording. I love how Kristen worded. You could just see him shaking his finger and doing
using,
that. You know?
Using that middle name to yell.
That's when you knew. That's why we all know the middle names of all of our kid friends from high school, like grade school. Do you know the middle names of your friends? I know all their names because mom yelled at them, so I know their middle names from being yelled at them when they did things wrong when we were all little.
So Ford, you know, Ford has previously said that or threatened to pull Lightning allocations from dealers, you know, because Ford, Ford ultimately decides which which dealers, you know, are going to get which vehicles, and you know, for dealers that they know are charging these excessive markups, they have mechanisms to do this. You know, they can just say, we're just, you know, instead of 100 Lightnings, you're going to get 10 or none. And, you know, those customers that ordered from those dealers, you know, they're going to have to go to another dealer. And I think, you know, especially for the early buyers, you know, that have placed reservations, this is one of the interesting things about this whole reservation process that, you know, manufacturers never had in the past. You know, in the past, you know, customers just dealt directly with dealers. You know, the manufacturers didn't have any idea who the customers were until after a vehicle was sold, and you know, then they got the warranty paperwork. Up to that point, they didn't know. Now they know who these people are that are doing the, you know, that place their reservations because you went online, you gave Ford all your information,
right.
And yeah, you know, so you know, they are going to help out, you know, help these customers. You know, if the dealers that they were working with have their allocations pulled, Ford will be working with those customers to redirect them to another dealer that will sell the vehicle to them at sticker or less. You know, probably not less, but certainly, you know, for at sticker price.
At the sticker instead of an extra $5,000 or $10,000 on there.
Yeah.
My friend bought, she had a Bronco coming in, and the dealer, like, out of the blue was like, oh, by the way, it's now $10,000 more.
What did she do? Did she still take it, or did she say thank you?
She worked. They ended up talking it down to, I think, $3,000, which is still $3,000 too much.
Not right. Yeah, yeah, that's still,
it's
not
just
right.
Like, it's, you know, a lot of people are like, I guess I'll just take it. And I went and talked to someone at a Ford dealership near my house a few weeks ago, and I was talking about the Bronco. They're like, yeah, we have a $20,000 markup on those right now.
Are you kidding? And they're probably selling everyone they can get at $20,000 above.
They had one. They had one that they could sell in stock, and they had two demos that they would be able to sell starting in February at that time. Jeez. So yeah. So no. Yeah, they're just. Yeah, we'll do what they. You know. And then my friend, there was the what was it? The BRZ that had the, you know, it's a $30,000 car with the $15,000 markup that I tweeted about. Yeah. And then I went to a Toyota dealership, and there was a GR86, same car, with a $14,000 markup. So it's out of control. Like, you walk in and you look at it, and I'm like, no, and they start walking towards me. I'm like, nope, and I just turn around and walk out.
Yeah, not interested. Bye bye.
Like, no, like, this is why people don't like dealing with dealerships. And the problem is, a lot of people, they associate the dealership with the brand. So even though it's not.
Because you've got that big sign out there that says Ford, Toyota, or Chevrolet, or Toyota.
Right. Yeah. So like, none of those brands are happy when their dealers do it. But yeah, still, you're in your head. The average consumer is like, that's darn that Toyota, darn that Ford. It's like, no, actually, darn that dealership. It's not the auto company.
Yeah, most people don't realize that these are independent businesses that are not owned by the manufacturer. Yeah.
It's Jim Smith Ford or,
darn that Jim Smith Ford.
Yeah. There's probably a Jim Smith Ford out there right now. It's like,
sorry,
hey,
Jim Smith, we don't really darn you. We don't know yet. You, we just
unless you are doing this, then darn you. But if you're not,
then accurately, we've shamed you.
Good on you, Jim Smith Ford. If you're not doing this,
and for what it's worth, Ford is not the only one trying to crack down on their dealers doing this. GM has also said the same thing. You know, they during their earnings call, they revealed that they got they've already gotten 110,000 reservations for the Silverado EV.
Wow.
So. You know, there's clearly a lot of interest in these electric pickup trucks. And actually, this is something that I was got a call the other day from a reporter for the Detroit News, because you know recently GM made the announcement that they are going to put $4 billion into their Orion, Michigan assembly plant where they build the Bolt today to convert that over to building the Silverado and Sierra EVs. And during GM's earnings call, Mary Barra said, "Yeah, we're probably going to do a third electric truck plant as well, but you know in the next year or so." So that you know they're committed to building a lot of electric trucks. They clearly think that that's where their business is going very quickly in the next 3 or 4 years. All right, last news item we've got is Rolls-Royce, also with EVs. Rolls-Royce recently finally announced that they're going to build an EV, which it seems odd to me that they waited this long because, you know, Rolls-Royce, if you think about the kind of cars they make and their customers and how those vehicles are used, always seemed like it would have been another perfect application for electrification. You know, they built a prototype Phantom EV back in like 2010 or 2011, and they took it around and demoed it for customers. And for whatever reason, they opted not to put that in production at the time. But they have an electric car coming out, I think next year or 2024, called the Spectre. And the for the Spectre, they're saying this article says that. It's already got the lowest drag coefficient of any Rolls-Royce to date at 0.26, which is pretty slick. But one of the things that they've done is they've redesigned the Spirit of Ecstasy. That's the classic Rolls-Royce hood ornament, the flying lady that you find on the front end of every Rolls-Royce. They've redesigned it to make it more aerodynamic, so you get less drag from that hood ornament. Have you taken a look at this thing?
Okay, I'm literally trying to tell the difference at a glance.
I mean, it's still like a very pretty thing that people want to steal off your Rolls Royce.
Mm-hmm. But that's why they have the little thing where you can like bloop, hide
it. You got it, and it disappears. Yeah. Yeah, it disappears when you... I have a little video of it popping up and disappearing.
I do too. I think, do we all?
I think we all
have to. That's the first time you have your hands in a Rolls Royce, you're like, hold please, hold I got to take a video of this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's still recognizable as the classic Rolls-Royce hood ornament, but, you know, it's a little bit smoother. You know, they've smoothed out some of the contours, and I think probably they've also made it shorter. It's about 0.68 inches shorter than before, so it doesn't stick up quite as much. But it it says here has a dynamic stance with one leg forward and knees bent.
Yeah, it's like one leg behind the other instead of legs together, which makes more sense if, like, as a human doing that, making that pose, that seems a lot more, I don't know, realistic.
Yeah.
So you don't care about the aerodynamics. You're just appreciating the realism.
If you're standing out on the front edge of the hood of the car, you know, you want to brace yourself. You know, you want to have your legs kind of staggered like that a little
bit. Flying over the top of the hood.
Yeah, what if we come to a sharp stop? You're, whoa, you have two legs together? No, that's just bad. That's just a bad... You're just going to fall over.
All right. Let's answer some listener questions. First up, ZBM327 on Twitter asks, or ZBM, because I'm not sure where this person's from. Will GM ever replace their vans?
Eventually?
Maybe.
Well, I mean, hopefully before technically, the post office they replaces theirs, but a bump.
They kind of have started with BrightDrop. You know, because I mean, a big market for vans is commercial vans, and so, you know, they created BrightDrop as a new division, a new business unit for the commercial vans, and they're all electric. So they're, you know, those are going to eat up some of GM's traditional van business. I would assume that at some point we'll see them do, you know, consumer electric vans, do something new. I mean, the GMC Savannah and the Chevy
Astro.
The Astro was the old midsize van.
I know, but they should bring it back, is what I'm saying. Because they had that sweet ad where it was driving around like Jupiter, and they had that Chevy Astro.
Well, I saw the other day. I saw somebody did a rendering. They took a Kia Carnival and adapted the front end of the Silverado EV to the Carnival to create a new Astro. It actually looked pretty slick.
There you go. See?
Yeah.
Let's bring the Chevy Astro back. I mean, it's a perfect name for an EV,
too. That's what we need to do.
Yeah.
Look at that. We're solving problems. We're starting our own EV company.
We need to come up with a better name than WebEv.
If you want to make a few bucks, go out and register the trademark for Astro Van, and then sell it back to GM.
There you go.
All right. Mike Enos asks, he's got two questions here. As cars become more like rolling computers, how long can we really expect the software updates to continue?
Forever. Just like they do on a regular computer.
Yeah, right. Well, realistically, it's going to be for as long as you want to keep paying for them.
Mm.
I think at some point it becomes like your old iPhones where you're just getting security updates. Like, you know, you have a 10-year-old, I don't know, let's say a 10-year-old Ioniq 5. At some point, it's not going to just keep evolving after 10 years, 15 years. But there might, there's a security update, so they'll just push it out. No, there's a security update, they push it out. And at some point, they'll keep going as long as there's anything that's going to get them in trouble.
Yeah. I agree. I think security updates and anything for regulatory compliance, those will be for as long as those vehicles are on the road. Probably at least 10 to 15 years. Things like feature updates, that's probably going to be more like, you know, what you see, you know, with an iPhone, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe a little bit longer. But, you know, beyond the first couple of years, you will probably have to pay for those updates. If you want those updates, you're not going to get free updates in perpetuity, at least not on more affordable vehicles. Maybe on high-end vehicles you might, but not on the more mainstream models. And then the other question that Mike had was simple. What's the best non-Tesla EV for most people that you can buy today in the U.S.?
I don't know if that's a simple question, but Ioniq 5. I'm just going to say it. I love the Ioniq 5. I'm sure you guys will probably say something else. Maybe the EV6.
Well, I mean, the other one I was going to suggest is the Kona EV, you know, depending on what size you need. The Kona is cheaper.
It's got
lots of range.
It does.
Best non-Tesla EV for most people.
I like that I didn't pick the car that I own.
Not the one I bought.
Not the one I bought, but the one that I want. Well,
granted, when you bought the Kona, the Ioniq 5 was not on sale yet.
I really wanted to wait, too.
Yeah. So.
But then I went into it like, it's probably not going to be nearly as good as what I have in my head. And then it was. So that's always a nice feeling when you... You really want a car to be good, and then it is good. And you're like, good. Whew.
Well, on Twitter, Brianna Wu actually responded to this when she said the Nissan Leaf. Put some performance tires on it. You have a hot little hatchback.
Do you though?
Yeah. I wouldn't call it hot. Even with good tires, I wouldn't call it hot.
No, the Nissan Leaf is a good car. It's been around forever. Kudos to for Nissan for coming out very early ahead of everyone else and getting into the EV game. But the Nissan Leaf is also the most boring EV on the planet.
Yeah.
It's kind of boring.
It's like
it starts at 30 grand and you can still get the $7,500 tax credit on there, another $2,500 if you in some states like California, I think. So, I mean, you can get a Leaf, theoretically for about 10 grand.
But it's not 150 that rate. That's like the 150 mile.
That's the 150 mile version. So,
if you're going to do that, just get the Mini SE and just lose like 10, 15 miles.
Yeah. I mean, that's...
Well, you have more room. I guess that's most people. I guess, yeah.
Depends what your needs are, what your wants are. But, probably the Leaf, the Kona, the Ioniq 5, are probably
the EV6.
Best.
I think that's
or
in
the
there.
EV6, yeah.
The EV6, throw that in there, too. Yep. I mean, it's for me, it's a toss-up between the EV6 and the Ioniq 5. It goes to what we were talking about earlier. Drive it and see which one is more comfortable to you.
Yeah, make sure the seats fit you.
Yeah, make sure, because they're a little different, but I would go with one of those.
I think the Kona is really actually a really good choice, because it's like six grand cheaper than either of the other Hyundai Motor Group vehicles, 258 miles. We drive that thing all over the place. It's fine.
Yeah, the only, for most people, if
you want something a little bit more dynamic, the other two are much better.
Yeah, I think the only restriction there, with the Kona would be if you do need to carry people in this back seat more frequently, and you want extra back seat room, then you want to go with the larger one.
Yeah, that's why I like the extra size, because I think the Kona is like a smaller, which is it's great, but a lot of people need a little bit more space, and the Ioniq 5, and the EV6 give that extra little bit of space. Kona, if you don't need the space, go for the Kona for sure.
With the front seat, for me to drive in the EV6, I sat in the back seat and still had like inches of knee room. I was like, whoa.
Yeah,
it's a lot bigger than you think. But when you drive it, it feels smaller. I don't know. Those cars are just... Yeah, Hyundai's really killing it. That's what it comes down to it.
Yeah, they are.
All right, another one from Brianna. Do you think the 911 or the Boxster will get an electric version first?
I saw this tweet yesterday, and I've been thinking about it all night. And so I still don't have an answer. And so on one hand, you think, well, maybe they want to do the 911 because they want to have this crazy, insane EV. Like, just be like... Just out of the gate, just like, look what we did. We're Porsche. We're going to do crazy. We have all this engineering. On the other hand, the Boxster would be a great sort of entry into that. So you have this like, okay, we have the Boxster. It's an EV. The 911's coming, but we're still going to make sure that we're still taking care of our like super hardcore 911 people. So my answer is, I don't know. I'm torn. I kind of am leaning towards the Boxster, but on the other hand, like just, to come out with an EV 911 just seems like pumping.
I have no idea. This is one of those explosions. I'm like, literally, it's a toss up to me. There's good reasons for both. I want to know what Brianna thinks. Brianna, tweet us and see which one do you think is going to get an electric version first.
I personally think it's going to be the Boxster, because 911, a little more traditional. I think they're going to do a hybrid version of 911, but the Boxster, because it's a mid engine layout, I think that they can stuff some battery in where the engine is today. It's a two-seater mid-engine. With the 911, packaging becomes a little more of a challenge for that one. So I think it's going to be the Boxster.
All right, so I'm going to go with the Boxster because Sam is smarter about engineering than I am. Also, I love the Boxster. I love the Boxster so much. I just love it. If I were not a journalist, if I were, say, a politician and I was on the take, I would...
Not that we're accusing Brianna of any of that, because she's no longer a politician.
Oh, no, not... Brianna. No, I was accusing just politicians in general. Because, all the journalists are on the take, and we're really not, because none of us have a 9/11.
Yeah. We don't all drive
Porsches. Or those that do usually have an old 911 that they've owned for 20-odd years, you know, since long before the prices went ridiculous.
Went crazy.
Yeah. We also, like, we keep track. Like, right now, prices are insane. But we really, as a whole, like, if you get in a shuttle van with a bunch of journalists, a car journalist, like, half of the discussion is how you were able to buy a vehicle at its value, when of its value. Like, okay, well, I was watching it, and then it's going to dip at this point, and then they bought it at, like, the least, spend the least amount of money.
The cheapest they could possibly can, like, exactly. It will never get lower than this now. Yeah.
Yes.
Automotive journalists don't make that much money. So
that's the end of the day.
Most automotive journalists cannot afford to shop on Bring a Trailer.
Oh, no, yeah. That's why we're always, like, making fun of Bring a Trailer. I mean, Kudos to Bring a Trailer for creating that site and creating the hype. And the people who are selling these vehicles that they've been keeping in a garage somewhere without touching it, like, good for you selling them.
See, I say not good for you. Unless you're buying a vehicle that was, like, this super fancy one-of-one, never-to-be-driven vehicle, drive your car.
Yeah, cars are built to be driven.
If you're going to buy it, drive it. Oh, but it's a limited. Who cares? Drive it. Somebody built it for you to drive, not just look at it and go, purdy.
I take back my you should drive your car.
Yeah, thank you, Robbie.
Yeah, that's live life.
Live life.
Live life.
All right. Gupta AJ asks, does the new Tundra have anything comparable to Super Cruise or Blue Cruise? My primary use would be on a straight 35-mile stretch of I-75 at night, and the dream is to drive across the country enjoying the wide-open western part a couple of times in the next 5 years.
No.
No, it doesn't, does it?
No. I don't believe so.
I don't think there's any.
I think the first Toyota vehicle coming to the U.S. market that has a hands-free system is the Lexus LS is getting the Teammate system, which is their version of this hands-free driver assist. And
I like that name, though.
Teammate? Yeah.
It's like a helper, like your team.
Yeah.
You're a team.
Like
you're
a little assistant, yeah.
And actually, this reminds me of something else that came up the other day. Farhad Manju, who's a tech columnist for the New York Times, wrote a terrible column about his experience driving the Cadillac Escalade. Which he quite fell in love with, to his surprise. And he actually made some good points in there about a lot of these modern cars are so good, you know, it's no wonder, you know, people want to drive them more, you know, and which is exactly the opposite of, you know, kind of what you really want to do if you want to, you know, improve the environment, is you got to get people to drive less. But, you know, then he goes on to talk about using Super Cruise. And he repeatedly calls this an autonomous and a self-driving system, which it is absolutely not.
Not.
None of these systems, there is not, even so-called full self-driving is a driver assist system. Any system where you still have to pay attention and watch the road is an assist system. Please remember that.
Yeah.
All right.
I wish Farhad, I'm friends with Farhad. He should have, like, reached out to me. And I think that comes down to, he's a columnist, so he's not a car person. So he's writing about things that are happening in his life.
I mean, he writes about technology.
But I feel like at the editing process at the New York Times, I feel like it must be incredibly siloed. Because they do have people who edit.
Who would know that.
Who would know that. But if you have a newsroom that's incredibly siloed like that, you allow these sort of weird errors to appear on your... In your newspaper, on your site, which is insane, because it hurts you so bad as
an automotive writer. He could have told them that was not true.
Exactly, and it hurts Farhad. It hurts the editors. It hurts the brand. I've worked at places where tech sites where people are like, oh, this is autonomous. I'm like, no, do not write that. Do not do this. And they reach out, they ask me questions, and I say, okay, that's not right. That's incorrect. Or you're framing it incorrectly. You have the information, but someone has told you via PR that this is what it is. And the reality is it is not that. And so, it is, I'm just like, oh, Farhad.
Poor Farhad.
All right. Next up, Gifted Napper asks, if you could add any one single driving law across the country, what rule would you make mandatory? Or what one current driving law would you change or eliminate if you could?
I would make cops have to pull you over for tailgating. Because I see people tailgating all the time, and then a police officer goes by, and no one does anything. And it's the most insane, dangerous thing ever. Like, tailgating on the highway, tailgating on back roads, tailgating is overall... I mean,
unless you're in a parking lot at a stadium before a football game.
Yeah, and you're just trying to leave.
Desperately, yeah. What one law would I make mandatory? I would like to see, you know what, because it causes so many almost near misses when I see on the road. I would like to see them consistently pull over people who just ride in the left-hand lane. I don't care if you're doing the speed limit or not. If the speed limit's 55 and you're just sitting, like, the left lane is for passing. I would like to see that enforced, because what happens is you have people, and it's not right, but then you have people who are just losing their mind behind that slow driver, and the minute they can go to the right and pass them, and the number of times that people do that, and they do it so aggressively because they're frustrated and angry, and they're cutting too close. And then if that slow driver's like, oh, wait, now I'm going to get over just as slowly as I've been driving in left-hand lane. Now the guy who's angry and passing him on the right is about to smack into him. Like, it actually is really super dangerous. It causes all this road rage. Just move over. Like, I would like to see that. Not because I want to drive 95 miles an hour. I just don't want to see people doing that and causing this sort of road rage situation that can get us all in trouble.
This is why I love driving in Germany. Because everyone...
I know. I was literally thought of that. It never happens in Germany. You're right.
Because it's illegal to pass on the right. And everyone just sort of follows the rule, which, you know, didn't work out so great like almost like 80 years ago. But now... You know,
yeah,
it's like everyone, you pass and you get back over to the right, and you pass it's and you beautiful. Get back over to the right. And
you never get stuck injured. You just drive.
You just drive. And everyone who's happy.
I want
everyone,
a law to make that happen here. I want a law for that to be like that's enforced. Like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the United States, everyone's just hanging out in the left-hand lane the entire time because everyone's very important.
Always.
We're all very important people. In Germany, everyone's over to the right, like working with the flow of traffic. It's amazing. And I think people assume that on the Autobahn, everyone is just like flying down in the left-hand lane. There's no one in the left-hand lane. There's absolutely no one unless you're
very,
like...
Very rare.
Yeah. Usually it's automotive journalists from the United States who are just happy
or
they can drive fast.
When you're passing, like you get up on a car in the right-hand lane, you pull over to the left, you pass them, you pull over to the right. It's a nice, perfect little box. You never just hang out in the left-hand lane.
Yeah, no one hangs out in the left-hand lane.
Or some rich guy with his Bugatti Chiron driving 259 miles an hour.
Yes, and then you get out of his way, which is easy to do because you don't drive in the left-hand lane unless you need to.
That's too much. But yeah. Anyway.
For me, it would be not so much a new law, but because seatbelts are already mandatory in all 50 states, but more enforcement of seatbelt laws. Because if you look at the traffic fatality stats, one-third of all of the fatalities of vehicle occupants involve people who are not belted.
Still?
Yeah. Yes.
What is happening?
I can't remember, and I wish I could remember because it was a couple of years ago. I was at some conference, and there were automotive safety experts from a couple of different like nonprofit groups who study what safety features are the most important ones and which ones currently are saving the most lives. And they were talking about the cost, and this is probably 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, if you want these advanced safety features, you're often having to pay extra to get them, or you have to jump up to a higher trim, so you're paying extra for that trim, so it makes some of them cost prohibitive. And there were two or three of these guys on the stage, and they all said the same thing. You know what? Those are all great, and they'll help you, but the single best thing you can still do to keep yourself from getting killed in an accident is put your seatbelt on.
It's already there in every car.
It's right.
It's there.
Yep.
Yeah. It's free. It's free.
Granted, you know, most people do wear seatbelts now.
Yeah.
But, you know, of the 39,000 people a year that die, you know, in traffic fatalities, you know, roughly about 30,000 of those are vehicle occupants. The rest are pedestrians and cyclists. You know, and one third of those are unbelted. Yeah. You know,
so like 10,000 people that could be alive if they just put their stupid seatbelt on. Like, come on, guys.
It's so weird. Do you ever drive without your seatbelt? Like,
I can't. No. It freaks me out.
Like I move in a parking lot and I'm just like... Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay,
right,
I'm
like if I've unbuckled my seatbelt and somehow I have to like move the car another 5 feet or something, I'm like, hold on, click, okay, zoop. Now I can't do it. It literally feels like I'm not ready to go, which is a good thing, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, even just moving cars around in my driveway when I'm doing a vehicle swap, you know, I I always have the urge to put on my seatbelt.
Yes. You know, I do the same thing.
I've been doing it for 40 years now, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, it's a muscle memory. Get in and put on the seatbelt.
My mom was a nurse, and she was always a stickler, even when I was a little kid, about wearing seatbelts back when nobody wore them and there were no seatbelt laws. And all you have to do is, like, spend a little time talking to a nurse or a doctor who worked in the ER, and they can tell you all the wonderful things that happen when you don't wear your seatbelt that you could be safe from if you just click that seatbelt. Have your mother tell you stories like that when you're 7, you will wear a seatbelt for the rest of your life. I was like, good job, Mom.
From WWP 2181, what's a feature you all wish was either standardized or included in all vehicles? To go extreme, what would your versions of the Homer be? As a reminder, the Homer has two bubble domes, one in the front, while one in the back is for quarreling kids and comes with optional restraints and muzzles. The engine sound causes people to think the world's coming to an end. There are three horns because you can never find a horn when you're mad. And they play the song La Cucaracha. Has giant cup holders, shag carpeting, tail fins, and a metal bowler hood ornament. Sam, as a fellow engineer, I know it's hard to design without constraints, but you can do it. Go nuts. I apologize for the sloppy tweeting. And they play the song Cucaracha has giant... Oh, no, okay, sorry.
Just
a copy-paste error there. So what would you want as standard on your cars?
360-degree camera for parking. Because I just watch people park, like, before I lived in San Francisco, I probably was a horrible parallel parker, but I'm not really sure because I never had to parallel park before that. And then I went, once I left San Francisco and I moved to LA, I lived on a residential street in LA for a few years, and I would watch people try to parallel park, and it'd be like a 20-minute extravaganza of someone just doing all the wrong things. And, you know, they didn't have, this is pre, you know, rear camera. So I think the 360 camera on all cars would be like super nice. Just so you can see, you're not going to bump into people, like children, especially, you know, big trucks, you know, a little kid runs out, a kitten, a dog, you can, you know,
also so you
park.
Can see where you are, you know, in the between the lines, you know, a parking lot.
Yeah, in a parking lot, sometimes, you know.
Because, you know, I sort of agree with you because I am the person, this is a 20-minute ordeal, I hate parallel parking because, I never have to do it.
Yeah,
I just never got good at it. I think I parallel park like 3 times a year, so I've never gotten comfortable doing it. But you know what I wish every car had ever? So I want heated everything. I don't want just heated seats and heated steering wheel. You can get the like armrests. They're heated. So when you put, I want everything heated. It is currently a high. We're at 27 degrees. That's the highest we've been in like
everything
a week and
heated.
A half, right? I want all the heated things to be standard.
Headrest.
And I don't want it just standard for me, the driver, because then my passenger or my people in the back, I want it to be standard. Like, if I want to heat this car up to feel like it's the surface of the sun, I want that to be possible. That's what I want. That's all I want. That's
it's actually more efficient if it's in the seat than it is the blowing.
That's why every
EV should have standard heated
seats.
Right,
so just warm me up and I'll be toasty and the world will be happier and my fingers won't be frozen as I'm trying to turn. Or like even the gear shift, like when you drive a manual, you have to grab the gear shift and it's like an ice cube. Wouldn't it be nice if the gear shift was like toasty warm when you grabbed that?
A heating pad like under where your feet go by the pedals.
Toasty up your feet?
Yeah.
See?
I've been trying to think about that. Like, how do I keep... Because my hands and my feet get cold. And they've all... It's always... I don't know why. Maybe because there's so much room. But
you're
look
so
how
tall.
Long.
You're
so
tall.
Far away
long,
from the rest of your body.
It's so far from my heart. Like, my arms... When I had...
Blood cools.
Yeah, I just can't make it. It just gives up and just turns around my wrist. When I had a suit tailored and the lady was like... Oh, she's like, you have really long arms. Like, yeah, I know.
Thanks.
At first she thought it was an error. She's like, wait, hold on. And she just kept having to make things longer and longer. But yeah, the feet warming thing would be outstanding. Just something.
Yeah. Something to warm. See? Warm all the things. That's what I want in a car.
I'll go with the infrared driver monitor that's in the F-150 I'm driving. You know, to make sure that you're watching the road. You know, that you're, because, you know, we have all these laws in a whole bunch of states about, you know, it's illegal to hold your phone while you're in the car, you know, illegal to text and things like that while you're driving. Yeah, that's great. But you know, that doesn't, that almost never gets, unless a cop happens to be sitting next to you, you know, while you're looking down at your phone, you know, it never gets enforced.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas if you had a system that was looking at, you know, where are your eyes looking? You know, make sure your eyes are watching mm-hmm. the road instead of looking down at your phone or anything else. You know, and the beauty of that, and actually this is something that, you know, will almost certainly be coming to all vehicles in the next few years. It's increasingly being added now, but one of the things in the infrastructure bill that was passed by Congress is that they directed NHTSA to develop a regulation to try to prevent drunk driving. And this is actually probably the route that they're going to take is with driver monitor systems, because, you know, these things can not only tell if you're distracted, and tell if you're drowsy. You know, I mean, I'm sure we've all driven at times when we're too tired to be driving, and, you know, mm-hmm. we felt like we're falling asleep at some point. You know, so it can detect all of this, and then, you know, just if you're not watching the road, you know, or if you've become incapacitated, if you have a heart attack or a stroke or something, you know, or go slip into a diabetic coma, you know, any of these situations, you know, then start slowing the car down, turn on the flashers, and bring it to a stop if you're unresponsive. Very simple, it's cheap, easy, it works, and, you know, that will actually probably save a lot of lives. All right, final one. More of a statement than a question here, I think, from Bryn Berenshausen. Wanted to share an unfortunate experience my friend is having trying to get a Ford Maverick. He ordered one back in October, a Lariat with the premium package to replace his hybrid Fusion, and was told to expect delivery in April. His dealership called this week asking if he'd be willing to drop the bedliner so he could get it sooner. Otherwise, he shouldn't expect it now until next year, which I'm assuming means 2023. He said sure, before he realized it meant dropping the whole premium package, including the adaptive cruise control, something that's a deal breaker for him. So today, I met him at a Hyundai dealership to test and drive a Santa Cruz, and now he's most likely going to get that instead, even though it's not a hybrid. I suggested he not cancel the Maverick order, just wait for it and sell it when it does come. But these are the games that dealerships are playing that really irritate people and give a bad reputation to the industry as a whole, because we suspect the dealership wants to be able to sell it at the market-adjusted rate now instead of the MSRP price that they agreed to in October. And unfortunately, Bryn's probably right about this one. That is probably exactly the case. And, you know, to be fair, you know, again, this is not a situation unique to Ford dealers. You know,
right.
Every manufacturer is experiencing this. You know, there's even been, you know, lots of reports on the Tesla forums over the years of, even though Tesla doesn't have independent dealers, of, you know, Tesla doing things like this, you know, when customers have gotten, you know, delivery dates for their cars, and then, you know, day before, a couple days before, they, you know, they get a call saying, oh, something's happened, your car's not going to be ready. We're going to reschedule you in about 3 weeks. And, you know, then that car ends up getting sold to somebody else, somewhere else. So, you know, there's all kinds of shenanigans that go on with retail, and it's unfortunate. It needs to stop.
Yeah. I mean, it is fortunate that there's a competitor.
Yeah.
The Santa Cruz, because the only thing that's kind of close to either of those is the Ridgeline, which is bigger. So it's kind of a competitor, but not really. It's in the Ridgeline's in a sort of weird spot right now. Because at one point that was the sort of like, hey, you just need a truck to do things, and you're not,
right.
You don't need something that's lifted off the ground. So, but yeah, I mean,
mulch hauler.
Yeah, you need to haul mulch, or you need to haul some things. I really like the Ridgeline. My wife was very upset that it wasn't an EV. Because she was like, she liked it because, like, the way the seats folded up in the back, and then the dogs could
like
in the back.
And it's a comfortable little truck.
Yeah, and you lift up the bed, and there's, like, giant, like, you could make a jacuzzi, I guess, out of it. The trunk the trunk under the bed. Now, the original is a great vehicle. Yeah. Santa Cruz, that's a win for Hyundai and that dealership. Now that dealership has it. This is a person who had a Ford hybrid before that.
Yeah. And you know,
yeah, they didn't just lose a sale. They lost, like, it was a conquest sale for Hyundai. For Hyundai, because they sold.
Hyundai needs to get a hybrid version of the Santa Cruz out
fairly quickly.
And, you know, the Santa Cruz is based on the Tucson, which is already available as both a hybrid and a plug-in hybrid. So, you know, it should be pretty straightforward for them to, you know, drop that stuff in there into the Santa Cruz. And I suspect that maybe for the 2023 model year, you know, maybe this fall, we'll see something like that coming from Hyundai dealers, especially given the success of the Maverick hybrid, you know, and how popular that is.
It's very weird. I just find it odd that like Ford came out and they had the Maverick hybrid. You're like, cool. But they didn't have the Bronco Sport hybrid. I'm like, all right. And they didn't have a Bronco hybrid, which I mean, the 4xe is out in the world. Nicole has one.
I do.
And so, and
it's out in, frozen in my driveway, covered in ice.
And then Hyundai came out, and then the you know, the Santa Cruz came out. But and there's already the hybrid powertrain for that platform. And you're just like, we're just going to do it. I'm always curious. I always want to be in the meeting. I always want to know, like, because they had to do some sort of research with some people somewhere and said, okay, this year we're going to do this, and then later we'll do this. I'm just curious what the timelines are for all these.
Having been in some of those meetings, you know, it's probably a case of, okay, we've got this much capacity right now to build the hybrid drive units and this much capacity for batteries, and, you know, to, you know, do the certification for, we know we can sell this many hybrid Santa Fes and Tucsons, and, you know, to add it to the Santa Cruz, we're going to have to take away some volume from Santa Fe and Tucson, and, you know, it's going to cost us this many millions of dollars to do another certification for the Santa Cruz hybrid. So until we have more, so that means that they're still going to sell the same number of total hybrids, but now spread over three models instead of two. So, you know, until
and
they
the
get
growth
more capacity,
market is the growth market is the Santa Fe and the Tucson.
Right. So until they get some additional capacity for batteries and the other components, you know, then, you know, and that's, and it's probably the same thing is true for Ford, you know, with the Bronco and Bronco Sport, that they're waiting until they ramp up more capacity for all the components they need.
Because they sell a gang load of those Escapes because they're everywhere. Yeah. Absolutely everywhere.
They are.
All right. That's it for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And, you know, if you like the show, give us a rating on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you're listening that has a rating system. It always helps. And tell your friends. And we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.